Okay, we're recording, and today is August 26th, and we're in Steenbach Library, and my name is Faith Hoffmeyer, and this is an interview with Jane Collins, and if you could spell your last name, that would be great.
Okay, C-O-L-L-I-N-S.
Great. And if you could just say your age and city of residence.
I am 64. I will be 65 in a week, so. And I live in Madison, Wisconsin.
Great. I'm just going to adjust the sound a bit. Can you spell your last name one more time so I can just see how it sounds?
Sure. C-O-L-L-I-N-S.
Okay. Okay. I think this should be good. Okay. So what was your occupation title when you left UW?
Well, I'm still here until May.
Oh, okay. I didn't even realize.
Sorry. So what's your current teaching occupation? Two courses in this fall. So I am Frances Perkins Professor of Community and Environmental Sociology.
Great. And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Alexandria, Virginia.
And can you just give a brief timeline of your education from undergraduate to graduate school?
Sure. I graduated from high school in Groveton High School, south of Alexandria. Went to the University of Virginia. And I think in an earlier interview I talked about being in the first open admissions class where women were admitted on an equal basis to men in 1972. And then I graduated there in 76 and went to the University of Florida where I got my master's and PhD. I finished there in 1981.
And then when did you arrive to UW-Madison?
In 1992. After having taught for about 7 years at the State University of New York at Binghamton.
So since you talked about that in your last interview, we can just skip right to
Wisconsin.
So what was UW-Madison like when you arrived?
The way that I felt when I first got here was that, coming from a small campus, was that I had arrived, I was a fish who had arrived in an estuary. It was like there were so many resources, so much going on, so much intellectual vitality, so much interdisciplinarity. And I was hired into a position that was split 50-50 between the Department of Sociology and the what was then the Women's Studies Program. It's changed names and become a department since then. And so I felt like there was a lot of intellectual excitement, a lot of support in the Women's Studies program, people who helped me learn to navigate the university. So I was just very happy when I got here.
So as you were an anthropologist by training.
Correct? Yes.
So what was that like teaching sociology and gender women's studies or being in the program in the department?
It was interesting and challenging, but as an anthropologist, I was kind of a political economy person, and I worked on labor and gender, and so topically, I didn't change at all what I did. It was just learning the new vocabulary of the new disciplines, in a way. So I had been very active in the Fernand Braudel Center for World Systems Research at SUNY Binghamton, which was predominantly run by sociologists. So I had a toe in the water anyway. And when I came here, I was asked to teach courses on agricultural development, which was an area that I knew, and on gender, which was something that I knew as well from kind of participating in the gender studies program at Binghamton. And I was asked to teach qualitative methods, which is what anthropologists do, but we didn't have the same names for the different methodologies that sociologists do. So part of it was learning the new vocabulary associated with that, learning how sociologists talk about things like validity and reliability. So that was a challenge.
How long was that adjustment period for you until you were comfortable with the vocabulary?
I would say a couple of years.
You see. And so when did you leave the GWS or the program at the time?
The first big transition for me was when I left sociology and moved to community and environmental sociology, which is a program, the two programs are joint at the graduate level. So that move did not, I could keep all my same graduate students. Mm-hmm. It didn't disrupt that at all. But we have separate undergraduate programs. And it didn't change my teaching at all. But I made that move because I felt that the traditions of field research and ethnography in CNU-SOCH were closer to my own anthropological training. Mm-hmm. So I could continue to do the same work I was doing, but in a setting where I just felt like I had colleagues who really got what I was doing a mm-hmm. little better.
Can you tell me more about that? What kind of setting was closer to your background?
Well, the community and environmental sociology program used to be rural sociology, and it was set up specifically to serve the people of the state of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So it involved doing hands-on research with communities, which is really close to the participant observation that anthropologists do. And in the other sociology department, there was a space for that, but it was predominantly, the research that's done there is predominantly quantitative, demographic, based on the use of data sets that's, you know, where you're kind of removed from the people behind the data. So it just felt like I was talking with people who understood what it was like to do primary data collection with the subjects of the research.
Okay. So that was the first move.
That was in 2000.
2000.
In 2014, having chaired the Gender and Women's Studies program and department twice, including during the period when we transitioned from a program to a department, and having loved every minute of my participation there, I just felt like something had to give. I was turning 60. I had been juggling since I came to Wisconsin the double service load that's involved with being in two departments, mentoring two sets of junior faculty, handling two sets of graduate students and supervising them, going to two sets of meetings and doing all that governance work. And so honestly, I just was worn out from like walking between the buildings at times. And I felt that if I was going to continue working into my 60s, I just needed to give myself a break. Mm-hmm. At the same time, that program had grown and blossomed, and they were hiring lots of new people. And I felt like it was an okay time to kind of cut those. I didn't really cut those ties. I'm still really personally involved with lots of people in the program as friends and colleagues. But I moved to 100% community and environmental sociology mm-hmm. in 2014.
So what would you say the strengths and weaknesses were of the or are of the CNE sociology department?
We have a group of really good people, and it's a fascinating interdisciplinary space. There are people with degrees in public health, history, anthropology, sociology, just a wide range of mm-hmm. different perspectives, public policy, for example. We are dwindling in numbers right now, and that is a challenge. To keep a program running, to keep training graduate students, to have enough people to mentor the new faculty that you are hiring. So I think that's one of the big weaknesses right now. We need to hire a few more people mm-hmm. to be at an optimal size.
Mm-hmm. So are there any notable people in the department you'd like to mention? Whether colleagues or any relationships that you have with people in the department?
Well, it's just such an incredibly collegial bunch. That's mm-hmm. one of the other strong points of the mm-hmm. department. We all get along really well. When we have an issue, we can talk it through openly. It's not dysfunctional like mm-hmm. Some other units that I have seen or heard about. So I can't really single out any of my colleagues that... they're all special.
Of course.
I will just say that.
And how does the department fit within its college, would you say?
It's one of three social science units, mm-hmm. the other being Ag Econ and also the what used to be called Ag Journalism and is now called Life Sciences Communication. So there's always a a burden of communicating to the scientists and practitioners in the college what it is that social scientists do. But I think that we are a pretty distinguished bunch and bring in grants and get a lot of media attention, and so I think that people understand the value of that.
Mm-hmm. And how would you say your relationship is with the dean or any of the department chairs?
I'm not really privy to that because I haven't chaired CNE SOCH, but I think that we have a good relationship with administration.
Great. And so how did the department change throughout the course of your career there? Or stay the same?
When I first moved over there, it was called Rural Sociology, and that reflected the fact that it was set up to serve the communities of the state in the 1800s, during a time when those inhabitants of the state were predominantly rural. Mm-hmm. I can't remember exactly what year we changed our name, but it reflected the fact that the state has industrialized, that it has cities, that the mission of serving the state looks somewhat different today, a lot different today than it used to. So we changed the name. We discussed it endlessly and decided that community and environmental sociology captured what we were doing. Mm-hmm. And to our surprise, in the year after we did that, we went from having 12 majors to having almost 100 majors.
Wow.
Because students were looking for a place where they could learn to work with communities and work on environmental and social issues. They didn't recognize that when they saw the title Rural Sociology, but now we have a really thriving undergraduate major as a result of that change.
And so what does serving the community look like now?
We have a lot of faculty members who have a joint appointment with Extension, so their activities out in the community are kind of prescribed. They go out and do economic development surveys. One of my colleagues, Catherine Curtis, is helping communities forecast and cope with issues of climate change. Another colleague, Randy Stoker, helps communities organize themselves for whatever kinds of community-driven projects they want to do. So he's like a facilitator of community initiatives. But for other people, it involves doing research in communities, like Josh Garoon working in Baltimore on public health issues, or Sarah Rios working in the Central Valley of California on valley fever as a health problem. So,
So did the department have any political affiliation, or was diversity an issue, or anything in that area that you'd like to mention?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by political affiliation, but I will say that there was a joke that was circulated when we first changed our name. I think it originates with Jack Kloppenberg, reflecting the social justice mission that the department has. He said that we could abbreviate community and environmental sociology as CommiSoch. So that may reflect the social justice concerns of the department. We have not historically been a very diverse department. After I came, we're pretty diverse in terms of gender right now. Mm-hmm. We have, at the moment, two faculty members of color, and one of them just got tenure, Monica White, which is just a great joy that has happened. And we're really going to try to build on the presence of Sarah and Monica to recruit students and to help us improve our recruitment process for faculty when we're finally allowed to hire.
So why study CNE SOCH?
What I tell students who are thinking about it as a major is that, first of all, I tell them that a lot of students who come into the program end up working for nonprofits, just not a way to get rich, but it's a way to do really meaningful work. Also a lot of students go into planning or policy jobs for state and local governments, government agencies, and some of them have started small businesses, healthy food catering or CSAs, and some have gone off to do more higher level policy work in Washington, D.C. With government. So those are the kinds of jobs that we prepare people for, and the students we attract tend to align with the social justice interests of the faculty members. They're trying to make positive change, and they want some tools to do that, like quantitative sociological tools, qualitative methods, analytical tools, and a way to think about policy. And I think we give students all those things.
Great. So now shifting over to your teaching career.
Okay.
What were some of the favorite classes that you taught at UW?
So I love teaching about... A lot of my research has focused on labor, and one way of studying labor that I stumbled upon was studying commodity chains. A way of putting labor relations in a larger context is to look at the power relations that structure their work, and commodity chains was a way to do that. So I have loved teaching courses on commodity chain analysis to graduate students, but also teaching a course that I think you taught on labor in the global food system that emphasized how different segments of the food system are structured by commodity chains and what that means for people's work, both in agricultural production, but also in food retail and food services. So I'm still teaching that course. I'm teaching it again this fall. I also was surprised to find how much I have loved teaching the intro to community and environmental sociology. And part of that is just the experience of having first year and second year students, especially first year students, in that class and exposing them to a whole range of topics. And of course, they're not all interested in every one of those topics, but inevitably there's something that really catches their imagination, and just seeing that on their faces and in the conversations that I have with them, to see them realize that this is something that they could study in college, something that they really care about, whether it's healthy food or environmental justice or immigration issues. We cover a really wide range of topics, and it's just fun interacting with those students.
Were any classes particularly more challenging than others?
There was a period when I was still teaching in gender and women's studies when I felt there was a kind of misalignment between what I had traditionally taught in that program and what students really wanted to learn about. So I was still teaching courses on gender and work, and courses on politics of gender, and the emphasis of the students who were choosing the major was much more on sexuality. And so I would have the experience of feeling like I wasn't offering people what they wanted. And that was, I don't know, it may have played some role in feeling that I should move my line. But I think it's just a reflection of how that field has changed as the area of sexuality studies has broadened and grown. There's a lot more material to cover, and I would say a larger percentage of the coursework that students do in that program now is focused on sexuality, which is extremely important, but not where an area where I do research myself, so I felt like I couldn't address it to the extent that the students wanted.
So what was your experience learning how to teach after graduate school?
It was like throwing me in the classroom with no training whatsoever, and that was challenging. I had learned to teach by the time I left Binghamton and came to Madison, but I think I learned by talking to my colleagues about what they were doing and what worked for them. And I think my biggest insight that I gained at Binghamton at some point along the way was that I could stop thinking about what students thought of me and whether they liked me as a professor. And if I just conveyed that I liked them and respected them, everything would be okay. And that is really simplistic, but it's really important. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that I didn't have the information to convey to them, or that I wasn't organized, or that I couldn't express myself clearly, but I was just so nervous in those first few years. And once I got over that, it really helped a lot. Mm-hmm. Also, I got older and no longer looked like I was a student mm-hmm. in the classroom. That helped too. Mm-hmm.
So how would you describe your teaching style, and how did that evolve during your time at UW?
I started out teaching smaller classes, so it was very interactive and informal. I think I've become, as the class size has grown, and especially as I've been teaching large lecture courses, I've adopted a more formal lecturing style, but I still try to be really interactive as much as I can, given mm-hmm. the constraints of the classes.
Mm-hmm. What are ways that you can be interactive in the classroom?
I should probably ask you what you think.
Open discussion.
But I try to ask questions that are not closed-ended. I don't mm-hmm. always succeed, but like open-ended questions where there is room for discussion. Mm-hmm. And I try to ask questions that require students to connect what we're talking about to their own experience, at least some of those kinds of questions, which is easy to do if you're teaching about something like food. Mm-hmm. Or work, really, because most students have had jobs. And then I try to use the whole range of traditional techniques, like in the large lecture class, have people pair off and discuss among themselves before reporting back to the class, just to give them a little break from listening to me and make speaking out in class less scary. Mm-hmm.
What are your likes and dislikes of teaching?
I love the interaction in the classroom. I think I'm not alone. I think every colleague that you asked this question would say that grading is tedious and hard, especially if if you've got a class of 40 people and you're asking them to all write a research paper, it's hard, mm-hmm. but it's absolutely essential because students need to learn to write mm-hmm. and to organize their thoughts. So
you mentioned that you also taught some graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
What were the differences between teaching graduate students versus undergraduate students?
Well, graduate students do the reading all the time, consistently. That's one thing. And they come to class prepared to carry the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go in there knowing what points you want to emphasize and clarify, but without having a script mm-hmm. That you need to follow. You can let things evolve. It can be a free-ranging discussion. So that's really wonderful. But also, I counted them up the other day as I get closer to retirement, and I've supervised 42 graduate students, PhD students, over the years. And that's that teaching that goes on when you're the primary mentor and supervisor for a PhD student is just really intense one-on-one, teaching them how to write a proposal, what their thesis should look like, giving mm-hmm. them feedback on multiple drafts. It's very labor intensive, but it's probably the most rewarding part of the job. Mm-hmm. I still have 16 students who need to get done before I have a year past retirement to continue supervising them, so I'm trying to get them all out the door.
Have you collaborated with any students professionally?
I have. I have written articles with four or five students, mm-hmm. and I co-authored a book, the book that I wrote on Milwaukee called Both Hands Tied, with a graduate student who was really important, who was a really important part of the research, carrying out the research for that project.
Mm-hmm. That's a great transition to research now.
Okay.
So can you talk a little bit about your research experience at UW?
Yes. So as I've kind of mentioned, with regard to teaching, my major research interests are labor and how globalization is changing work relationships and working conditions in different parts of the world. So I've worked in Latin America, in Peru and Brazil and Mexico, and also in the U.S. on that issue. And related to it, but somewhat distinct, is an interest in what kinds of things count in our economy. So when I was studying labor in Peru in the 1970s for my own dissertation research, I realized that a lot of the farm work that was going on what were then called peasant land holdings in the Andes, never entered the official record books. It was self-provisioning. And then when I came back to the States and was working in with the Women's Studies program a bit in Binghamton, I realized how parallel that was to things that people were saying about housework. Hmm. The fact that there's all this work that goes on in the United States and other parts of the world, housework, care work, what some theorists call social reproductive labor, that also wasn't being measured. So while I've been studying work for my whole career, I haven't only been studying paid work, mm-hmm. and I've been really interested in how those two big pools of labor interact.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about that? How do they interact?
So the most recent book that I wrote is called The Politics of Value, and it's where I've thought about that the most in the most in-depth way. And I look at three movements that I argue are struggling to make sure that some of that unwaged work gets counted. Mm-hmm. So one of the ways that we know that unwaged work matters is that it supports people who go on to become wage workers. So we've known since the 70s or 80s that housework reproduces the labor force. It cares for infants, it socializes children, it cares for people when they're sick and in their old age. If people had to buy those services on the market, not only would it change, you know, that they're not available right now, mm-hmm. but it would mean that labor would have to cost a lot more than it does. So I'm also interested in the fact that immigration draws on a pool of unwaged labor in the countries where immigrants come from, where when people come to the United States from Mexico, for example, they have been fed and clothed and educated and socialized somewhere else. They come to the United States for their working years. If they get injured in a meatpacking plant or on a construction job, they go home to their communities in Mexico or they retire there. Mm-hmm. And so the costs of that labor are not borne mm-hmm. in the United States. So those are just two examples of the way that unwaged labor supports waged labor in the economy.
Mm-hmm. So how was your research funded?
Most of the time I was able to find funding from the National Science Foundation for my research in Brazil and the apparel industry research that I did and the most recent project on politics of value. But the Inter-American Foundation funded my early research in Peru. And the Department of Workforce Development in the state of Wisconsin mm-hmm. funded the work I did in Milwaukee on low-wage service sector workers.
Was funding difficult to receive?
No, I wouldn't say difficult. Okay. Sometimes I had to revise a proposal and submit it a second time, but that usually, if not the first or second round, mm-hmm. I was usually able to get funding.
Can you talk a little bit about your research in Brazil?
In Brazil, I'll say, first of all, what led me to do research in Brazil. I had done my original doctoral research in Peru, mm-hmm. and I thought I would always continue to work in Peru. I had invested in learning the Aymara language. Oh. And when I left the field in 1980, a Maoist guerrilla movement called Shining Path, or Sendero Luminoso, came out from underground. And it beheaded all of the community leaders in the villages where I had worked and basically terrorized the countryside there for the next 10 years. And so I wasn't able to return to Peru. So I thought about where I could do further research. My doctoral advisor was a Brazilianist, Charles Wagley. And I thought northeastern Brazil has large land holdings called fazendas that are very similar to the big haciendas in Peru. It's a semi-arid environment. The peasant communities look very much the same. I'll have to learn Portuguese, but I did that. And so I did work in northeastern Brazil in an area where the state had built a dam and flooded peasant communities and set up commercial agricultural production, irrigated agriculture. And so I was looking at what happened, how those big enterprises reincorporated the people who had formerly been independent small farmers or sharecroppers onto their big enterprises for export production. And they were producing mangoes and grapes and many other different kinds of tropical fruits and crops. So I had two different field research periods in that part of Brazil.
Mm-hmm. And when did you... So 1980 is when you stopped doing your research in Peru. Then you were in Brazil until...
From about 90 to 93.
90 to 93.
And during that time period, I came to UW. Mm-hmm. And soon after I got here, something was happening in the nation that was also beginning to percolate at UW, which is there's a lot of concern in the country about labor conditions in factories, mm-hmm. particularly apparel factories. The National Labor Committee, headed by a man named Charles Kernighan, was beginning to do these exposés. The moment when it really hit public consciousness was when Kathy Lee Gifford, who was an anchor on one of the morning news shows, was exposed as she had a line of clothing that I think was marketed through JCPenney or Kmart, I can't remember which, Walmart. And Kernighan exposed the fact that the clothing line that she was marketing to young girls was being produced by child labor in Guatemala. Mm-hmm. And she cried on her show when she found this out. She wanted to remedy the situation, but it really brought to attention, mm-hmm. to the public attention, that a lot of the things that we were buying, particularly in the big box stores that were really growing during that time period, were not produced under the best working conditions. Mm-hmm. So I attended a couple of events on campus about this issue, and I just thought, well, this is what I want to study next. Mm. I wasn't quite sure how, but that eventually evolved into the research for my book, Threads, that compares apparel production in the U.S. and Mexico. Mm-hmm. But early in that period, I guess I was around 96 or 97 when I was beginning to develop that interest. Mm-hmm. And in 1998, the U.S. Department of Labor maybe it was 97, the U.S. Department of Labor was also becoming involved with this issue. And under the Clinton administration, they set up something called the Apparel Industry Partnership that was setting up a voluntary code of conduct that would guide efforts to improve working conditions in that industry. Mm-hmm. And so in 1998, a number of universities decided that they were going to develop their own codes of conduct that would set standards for the apparel that had their logos, mm-hmm. that they felt like they could, they couldn't influence every apparel manufacturer, but they had some leverage over the people who produced Bucky Badger apparel, for example. So the UW became involved through the Collegiate Licensing Corporation, which oversees all of the trademarking that the mm-hmm. UW does. And it became part of a task force of 15 schools that were drafting a code of conduct for the CLC members. And in November of 1988, they kind of released the draft code for a 60-day comment period. So when I first remember being exposed to that was a meeting in Memorial Union in, I think, January of 1999 that was convened by David Ward, and I think it was overseen by Casey Nagy, who was a university lawyer at that time. And I went because I was just interested in this issue, and there were tons of students there, university lawyers, a handful of professors from the economics department, and there was a very heated discussion that was going on. I didn't realize it, but the students on our campus had were part of a growing network across campus called United Students Against Sweatshops, and they hadn't, I don't think they had formally formed a chapter here, but they had been in contact with their colleagues nationally. And they came in prepared to critique the code. And they said, okay, this is fine as a starting point, but in order to ensure that people are doing what they say they're doing, we have to know the locations of the factories. Mm-hmm. And the university lawyers came back and said, you can't do that. That's a trade secret. That's what the companies have been telling us. And the student said, nevertheless, we're going to put that in the code. And then they said, and also, there's no requirement for a living wage. You're saying here that you have to follow the minimum wage or the prevailing wage. We want a living wage. And the economists then raised their hands and said, nobody knows what a living wage is. Who can define that? And the student said, well, we think that maybe it can be defined. Let's ask some academics. And then the student said, there's nothing in here about free association and collective bargaining. And that's, you know, that's central. And the economist said, but China, how so many companies are producing in China and they don't have free association and collective bargaining. So, and then finally the student said, and there's nothing in here about protecting the rights of women workers. At which point everybody else in the room said, what does that have to do with anything? And the students then decided to educate people by talking about the fact that pregnant women were fired, that women were forced to take birth control, that sexual harassment and sexual violence were problems, and everybody was like, oh, we didn't know that. So the concern that the students raised at that meeting evolved into sit-ins at Bascom Hall and teach-ins, and with a number of other people, I went to do some of the teach-ins there. And David Ward eventually supported a requirement for full public disclosure of company names. And when they wrote that into the code and gave and published the code, immediately Nike published the factory locations that it had previously said were a trade secret, and decided it would get out ahead of the game by publishing them all online so that you could look up any item of clothing through the UPC code and find out where it was produced. So that was not so hard. There was also, Ward also agreed to convene a symposium on campus. He tasked the La Follette Institute with doing this. John Witte was then directing the institute, bringing scholars from all over the country to say what a living wage was, if it could be determined and how you would do it. And there was a set of proceedings that were published. The consensus was that, yes, you could do it. You could base it on a market basket methodology. It had been done. It could be done. So that was good. And he agreed to include provisions for specific language about women workers. There was no agreement about the issue of free association and collective bargaining. So students continued to press on that through the next couple of years. And then at that same, in March of 99, David Ward established what was then called the Collegiate Licensing Commission Task Force Advisory Committee, later shortened to the Labor Licensing Committee, and that committee has changed names probably 10 times over the intervening years. And I'm not completely sure that it still exists. I went online to try to find out, and I think it may be defunct now. But it was supposed to have 3 faculty members, 3 academic staff members, and 3 students. And it was supposed to advise David Ward on all kinds of issues related to compliance with the code of conduct. And I was on that committee from 1999, I would say, until about 2015, with the exception of years that I was on sabbatical and, you know, just, so I kind of had a window into what was happening on campus, mm-hmm. which is one reason that I wanted to talk a little bit about this in depth today, yes. because I don't think there's any other place where an account of this is written down. I don't think there's any central office that has all the records. Some of them are in the labor licensing office files. Some of them are in the USAS files, which later evolved into SLAC, the Student Labor Action Committee. But because of student turnover, nobody has the complete picture. So I have put together a box of all the materials I've saved over the years. It's got clippings from the campus papers, from the national press, because UW-Madison began to make it into the national press very quickly. It's got some of the meeting minutes. It has letters from factory workers in Central America to our committee, signed by hundreds of workers. You know, it's got lots of really interesting things. So I hope there's a way to cross-reference the interview to that box of materials, because the State Historical Society has said that they definitely want them. And so many of the students have gone on to become labor organizers over the years that it's kind of like a who's who of that international labor organizing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the code of conduct, I want to say a little bit about how it worked, because what's really unique about what UW did is that we developed a model, not completely on our own with a few other campuses, but we really pioneered it, that works for making codes of conduct effective. And that had never been done before, and it's a really important model. And it was, it had to deal with 2 really specific aspects of the global apparel industry. One is that apparel production occurs in many different countries. The United Nations International Labor Organization has said it's a one world employer. And so you have to deal with the fact that if workers organize in one place, or if restrictions pop up in one place, the brands can pull the contract and go somewhere else. So we needed to be constantly aware of the fluidity of the industry. But also, the industry, the brands contract with someone else, another company, which may contract with a factory, which may subcontract with smaller factories. So it's got this very complicated subcontracting structure. And so what that means for trying to enforce a code is that the brands can say, we didn't know what was happening. It's not our responsibility. No, it's the factory's responsibility. The code was written to say that the brands had responsibility, but that didn't mean that they didn't try to use the subcontracting structure as a way out. So how are we going to enforce this? Clearly, UW personnel, we're not going to go down and check out factories. So two organizations arose in 1999-2000 that were each proposing a different way of doing this. One was the Workers' Rights Consortium, which still exists, and it had a model that was based on workers in the factories reporting violations. And I'll say a little more about that in a moment. But the other organization was part of the lineage of that original Fair Labor Apparel Industry Partnership. That evolved into the Fair Labor Association. And they wanted to ensure compliance by using third-party auditors, auditors who might do, who were mainly involved in financial auditing, but who they felt could also do labor practices auditing. And they would do, they would announce that they were coming, and then they would go to the factory. And the students were very unhappy with that prospect because they felt that it gave the factory owners time to clean up their act, to hide abuses, and to do business as usual during the period when they were not being audited. So there became a struggle. There was a struggle that unfolded on the UW campus over which agency, which organization the administration was going to choose to enforce the code. And this resulted in more sit-ins in Bascom Hall. The students very dramatically bike-chained themselves to the stair railings in Bascom Hall. The campus administration called the police. The students were arrested, but then later released. There was just a lot of controversy. And I didn't know it at the time. No one knew it at the time. But one of the things that made the administration so committed to the FLA model as opposed to the WRC model preferred by the students, and I still don't think this is, people are widely aware of this, but was because they were in negotiations with the Chazen family for the new wing of the, what was then the LVM, the Chazen wing of the LVM, or the Chazen Museum of Art. And Jerome Chazen was the CEO of Liz Claiborne Corporation, which had been a big player in the Apparel Industry Partnership and was a big player in the FLA, and really was pressuring the UW, I believe, to adopt that model. So the students were not relenting, though, and so eventually the campus decided to join both. And I'm not sure if it's still a member of the FLA, but it's still a member of the WRC. So the process that the WRC had was working out in connection with the students, with USAS, was when workers in factories that produced UW apparel experienced a code violation. So if they were being forced to work overtime, unpaid overtime, or if they were, they were being served food that was not edible in the cafeteria, or if people were being blacklisted for trying to form a union, they would contact WRC, and the WRC would investigate those violations and provide documentation, and then students would pressure the administration of their university to cut the contract with the brand that was producing the apparel, which led during, you know, to many more sit-ins of Bascom Hall. And in most cases, this led to the brand making the workers whole and fixing the situation. So, I mean, the WRC brought that information to the Labor Licensing Committee, but usually it took pressure from the students to get the committee to pay attention or just to kind of focus their attention, I guess. And so this model was using what came to be called the name and shame approach for the brands to the advantage of workers. Sometimes people also call it the fishbowl model because it like makes visible what the brands are doing. And students would not only hold sit-ins that on their campuses, but they would also, in some cases, picket the outlets where the brand was being sold to make the public aware and to draw in support from faith-based communities and just consumers more generally. So the process of enforcing the code was bumpy. It was not without confrontation. And when, as I alluded to before, in cases where the UW would say to brands, look, it's pretty clear to us, we see evidence here that you're violating the code, they almost, to a person, initially denied that those violations were occurring. When they saw the evidence, they said, contrary to the code, that the responsibility lay further down the line. The university would say, go back and read the code. But in almost all cases, they eventually would acknowledge the situation and fix it. And the first big success came in 2001 when some workers at the Kukdong factory in Puebla, Mexico, contacted USAS and WRC and said that people were being fired for trying to form a union. They were being blacklisted and fired. And students demonstrated, and the LLC told Nike and Reebok that they would be in violation of the code and lose their contract. And Nike agreed to reinstate the workers. So that was very empowering for the students, and it kind of proved the model could work. There was another case that year with New Era Cap Company, which actually had a factory in New York, so this is not only internationally. And they agreed to reach a settlement with striking workers to remain in compliance with the code. And so 2002, 2003, there were similar cases in El Salvador and at the BJ&B factory in the Dominican Republic. And so people were really getting the hang of how this could work and becoming very encouraged. Mm-hmm. In 2004, we had an instance where Land's End, the Wisconsin company headquartered in Dodgeville, had illegally blacklisted workers producing some of their apparel. And when they didn't remediate, UW ended their licensing contract. So that was, I think, the first case where we showed that, you know, we meant what we said. And then in 2007, we kind of hit a snag. And this was with Adidas. The UW identified a number of violations at a factory in El Salvador called Hermosa, where Adidas produced licensed apparel for the university, and Adidas said, it's not our responsibility. We do not acknowledge or agree to that part of the code that says that we're responsible what factories down the line do. And we will contribute to an emergency fund for workers who've been illegally fired and blacklisted to give them some support. But we're not going to acknowledge our responsibility by forcing the factory to rehire them. So they were trying to establish a legal precedent there. And so that was something where the university was not willing to cut the contract with them. It turns out that soon after that, I don't know if there was a connection, but soon after that, Adidas became the company that produced the apparel for our athletes, which was a much bigger contract than just producing licensed apparel for consumers. So, but anyway, the students were upset, but we, you know, kind of let that sit. But there's an ending to that story, so that I'll come to in a bit. In 2008, there was a really significant victory in Honduras. Honduran workers were trying to organize a union in a factory that produced for Russell Athletic, which is a division of Fruit of the Loom, a really big company. And the owner of one of the factories closed it, and the workers contacted WRC and USAS. And once the WRC verified what had happened, the students pressured their administrations, and UW dropped Russell as a supplier, and the students started picketing outlets for those goods. And Fruit of the Loom just said, okay, this is a nightmare. We are going to get out ahead of it. And so instead of denying the charges or fighting them in court or trying to do the least possible to fix the situation, they agreed to reopen the factory, to pay the workers for their lost earnings, to recognize the union, to negotiate a collective bargaining agreement with them, and to adopt a new approach that would assure freedom of association in all of the factories that produced for them in Honduras, and would commit, they wouldn't work with a factory owner who didn't commit to bargaining with the union. So this was called, they called it the Honduras Labor Framework. And things are still not great for workers in Honduras. It's a very challenging environment, but the Fruit of the Loom factories were kind of like a bright spot and hope, you know, in that situation. They also agreed to take a similar position with regard to unions in their factories in El Salvador. So in 2010, the UW cut its contract with Nike because it failed to pay severance to workers in 200 factories where they had produced licensed apparel. And Nike made full restitution to the workers, and then the contract was reestablished.
When was it reestablished?
I think in 2010.
Okay.
And then to come back to Adidas, there was a really interesting episode in 2011 with a factory in Indonesia called PT Kaizong. And in the spring of 2011, the factory produced for Nike and for Adidas. And in the spring of 2011, the owner disappeared with the factory's money, leaving the workers owed over $3 million in severance. And in response to pressure from WRC and USAS, Nike agreed to go ahead and pay the workers their share. But Adidas, standing on this principle of not having responsibility for subcontractors, said no. And USAS began pressuring campuses to cut their contracts with Adidas. But by this time, Adidas was producing our football players' uniforms, and the administration was not willing to do that. So it turned into a protracted struggle. The university lawyers believed that cutting the contract would be a breach of contract, that cutting it for the team apparel. And so they thought they would be sued. And also they were worried that football players wouldn't have uniforms. So the administration, the students kept the pressure on, and the administration agreed to ask the court for a declaratory judgment that Adidas had violated the licensing agreement and they were within their rights to cut the contract. Mm-hmm. And so the university argued that if the code of contract didn't apply to subcontracted factories, then it had no meaning whatsoever because there are no brands that produce their own apparel. And the organizing committee of the workers at PT Kaizong joined as parties in the lawsuit. And I was in the odd position of going with Lydia Zepeda, a professor in SOHI, the School of Human Ecology, down to meet with the lawyers for the state of Wisconsin in the Justice Department, which that was during the Scott Walker administration. to explain to them how they could defend the university in that lawsuit, taking records, explaining to them the name and shame model, the fishbowl model, how the WRC worked. And so that was a very interesting experience. And in the end, the court ruled in favor of the university. It was just a declaratory judgment that was attesting to the facts of the case. It wasn't binding, but Adidas could see the writing on the wall. And within weeks, it asked to meet and negotiate and ended up paying the workers in full. So that was a very important precedent that the UW set, mm-hmm. because the campus administration was willing to put some resources behind what was, you know, the model.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result of these campaigns, the principle of brand responsibility was established. Workers in factories around the world, really, were gaining experience and confidence in waging these kinds of campaigns. And I really believe that the model that the students created and then other activists, students around the country created, but that really was pioneered here at UW, mm-hmm. has led to significant improvements in working conditions in the industry, not just through each individual case that came before the WRC, mm-hmm. but because of a kind of demonstration effect. Each factory that produced Bucky Badger wear also produced other stuff. And so if they improved conditions, they were not going to just do it on the line for Bucky Badger wear. They were going to do it across the board. Mm-hmm. And their competition would see that they were getting contracts and they would emulate. And also the industry was beginning to hire compliance officers and train them. And so I think that overall, the changes were spilling over and changing what was considered as best practices in the industry. And another really important effect of this was that, as I mentioned, the strengthening of worker organizations mm-hmm. abroad. And in 2013, in a meeting in El Salvador, unions from all over the world came together. Honduras, El Salvador, the Dominican Republic, Cambodia, Indonesia, Bangladesh, India. They all came together and they formed an organization called the International Union League for Brand Responsibility.
Hmm.
And they basically made a pact to support each other so that if one factory was having a problem and that factory produced for Adidas, workers in factories producing Adidas for Adidas all over the world would stop work.
Wow.
And workers in retail outlets that sold Adidas would stop work. And students would picket mm-hmm. those stores. And so they developed a very effective model that's been tried now in Cambodia
mm-hmm.
and in India and in a few other places to get this global solidarity network in place that
mm-hmm.
makes it more difficult for a firm to just say, okay, they're striking at my factory in Cambodia, I'm going to move to El Salvador. And so mm-hmm. it solved that problem of footloose factories to some extent. Or it's a first step towards solving mm-hmm. it, I guess. At the same time, I think that the allies in the U.S. have been weakening. You've got this strengthening going on in the developing world,
mm-hmm.
but USAS is a pale shadow of its former self. I don't think the LLC is really functioning anymore. There's still slack on campus, but they are taking on a broad range of issues, not just
mm-hmm.
apparel sweatshops.
Mm-hmm.
There's still the strong institutional infrastructure of the WRC in
mm-hmm.
place. And just last week, they negotiated a binding agreement among big brands in Lesotho to end gender harassment and violence in their factories.
Mm-hmm.
So the landscape is a little different now than it was 20 years ago,
yeah.
but there's still some things in place that can continue to fuel improvements.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a very long-winded answer.
That was great. Where to start? So what does that mean for the future then, if it's weakening domestically?
Well, these things wax and wane.
Mm-hmm.
labor unions generally have been on the decline in the United States, especially after Act 10 in Wisconsin and the decline of public sector unions. So I've seen it wax and wane enough times to think that if we can hold on to the infrastructure, mm-hmm. that in 5 years there might be a really strong cohort of students who are, you know, want to reinvigorate this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the, you know, the seeds of that kind of revival are already there. The kind of language that started at Occupy Wall Street mm-hmm. has continued in some of the, you can see it in the Democratic presidential campaigns, student support for certain Democratic candidates. You know, we still have the TAA, even mm-hmm. though it's no longer a bargaining unit, it still exists on campus. I think that this, you know, there's a possibility that unions will make a comeback.
Mm-hmm. So what makes student involvement and student passion so impactful rather than just like professionals and academics in a committee?
that's a really good question. Students have so much energy, and the thing that always impressed me here was that they, okay, so I made a snide remark earlier about graduate students do the reading, meaning undergraduate students don't always, but when they find a topic that they really care about, they do the research. They became experts on the apparel commodity chain. They read everything that was coming out. They, you know, really, really gained the knowledge that they needed to be informed activists.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. They just had the commitment. Mm-hmm. You know, faculty members are juggling multiple responsibilities. Faculty members tend to work on a model of writing articles that don't get published till 3 years down the road, mm-hmm. whereas students were, we're really innovating in mm-hmm. the ways that they communicated with workers in developing countries. They would just go down there.
Mm-hmm.
In Puebla, for example, for the Kukdong factory, mm-hmm. David Alvarado, who has a radio show on Wart here in Madison now, went down there and, you know, collaborated with, conversed with the workers mm-hmm. to find out what was going on. I remember in strikes in Central America, I think it was in El Salvador, one of the actions there, a student said, what we really need is to give the workers a cell phone.
Hmm.
And I said, well, okay, I can do that. I can pay for a cell phone if that's what you need. And they got a cell phone to the workers in El Salvador so they could communicate directly with the WRC.
Hmm.
So they were, you know, just out there problem solving, and I remember that energy myself from the 60s and 70s in the anti-war movement, and they just have more energy. Yeah.
So how are you working with students besides being on the committee? Like, what other contexts were you engaging with students? For example, when what setting was that when a student said, we need to get someone a cell phone?
I was for a while, you know, every student organization needed a faculty advisor. So for a while, I was the faculty advisor for USAS on mm-hmm. Slack. And I would do regular teach-ins then, because every year there would be new people coming in who knew nothing of what had happened before. And I would say, okay, this is the history.
Mm-hmm.
And then, a lot of the students were sociology students.
Mm-hmm.
So, and a lot of this, there were grad students who were mentoring the undergrads, and a lot of them were sociology grad students. Mm-hmm. So that was, there were channels of communication that mm-hmm. were through that too.
And also, what did your membership entail with the Labor Licensing Policy Committee, besides everything you mentioned, especially with pressure from students? But what were other like day-to-day roles?
We were looking at alternative models for developing relationships with factories. Mm-hmm. So for a long time, we considered the designated suppliers program, which was a way of developing a long-term working relationship with particular factories and mm-hmm. saying to brands who wanted to produce logoed apparel, you have to choose from one of these factories. But it turned out that that was in violation of trade law. It was kind of seen as giving an unfair advantage to those factories. Mm-hmm. So we went through a long period when, right after 2008, when Obama came into office, his Justice Department agreed to evaluate the practice and see if it would be legal. I think it was eventually decided that it could be done, but it took so many years to come to that conclusion that I think the Collegiate Licensing Committee had explored other ways of getting there. We always had a representative from the university Collegiate Licensing Commission person, and in the early years they were pretty ambivalent about the code of conduct, but they really took it on and embraced it by the later years, and so they were finding ways of recommending factories that were known to have good working conditions, and it seemed like the DSP was perhaps no longer as necessary. Mm-hmm. We also had yearly conferences. We tried to have yearly conferences. I can't say we did it every year, mm-hmm. where we brought in people from the WRC and sometimes from Adidas or some of the brands mm. to just give talks and be on panels to educate students about the issue. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we hosted workers from countries that produced in factories producing our brands, and mm-hmm. they came and gave talks. So there was a lot of different day-to-day activities mm-hmm. that went on.
And what about with Slack when you were overseeing that organization?
Yeah, I wouldn't say overseeing. I would say being a liaison.
Okay, liaison.
Because they really had their own ideas. But, they did teach-ins.
Okay.
They were often very instrumental in lining up the speakers to come in for, especially the workers. Mm-hmm. They would, like, Slack or USAS branches around the country would go together and say, okay, we're going to bring in this person from India or Bangladesh, like after the fire mm-hmm. in Bangladesh, bringing in workers the building collapse mm-hmm. in Bangladesh, the Rana Plaza collapse. They would say, we're going to bring some workers to talk about that, and to reduce costs, we're going to have them visit 10 campuses. And so mm-hmm. the students would kind of get that organized. And then the Labor Licensing Committee would endorse it and promote it. Mostly that.
You mentioned a little bit about media coverage earlier, but how would you say the UW campus and the activism at UW and all of these campaigns were covered by the media, if they were?
So there was a lot of coverage in the early 2000s, I would say, mm-hmm. but through the decade of the 2000s, 2000 to 2010. Stephen Greenhouse at the New York Times, who's their labor reporter, was really interested in the movement. And mm-hmm. so he ran articles whenever he could. We had our own John Nichols here in Madison, who would write things for The Nation. Liza Featherstone at The Nation she wrote a book about United Students Against Sweatshops. Mm-hmm. So she wrote a lot of columns for different, progressive publications about the movement, and you know, UW was always prominently mentioned because it was right out in front, cutting their contracts first, pressuring the brands first, mm-hmm. Supporting the WRC, mm-hmm. And then in the lawsuit against Adidas. And the Chicago Trib picked up on it, Washington Post. So it was covered pretty widely in mm-hmm. the mainstream press at the time. As an example of an interesting student-led social movement, and as a reflection on industry practices.
Mm-hmm. So how does this all tie into the Wisconsin idea then?
That's, so I've thought a lot about that because, the sociology department, Patrick Brenzel kind of spearheaded this Wisconsin idea course that's been offered now for maybe 4 years, three or four years, bringing together people to talk about the Wisconsin idea. And so to do a semester-long course that's open to the community. So I've had a lot of conversations with Patrick and Chad Goldberg, who facilitated it, about what that means. Mm-hmm. The Wisconsin idea, when it was originated, really was about providing expertise to the state, to state lawmakers and to state bureaucrats for devising programs like Social Security and workers' compensation and new labor laws and but it has always, there's also been an industry component. Mm-hmm. So the state laboratory of hygiene supporting milk pasteurization and other kinds of health initiatives. And less emphasis on supportive social movements, mm-hmm. although I think to some extent we have a school for workers that supports labor, for example. Mm-hmm. So in this case, I think it kind of fits all of those initiatives. It's a way of helping industries develop best practices, supporting an activist movement that brings together workers and students, and giving the state campuses some regulatory tools for governing, how their logoed or branded goods are produced. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a really robust example of the mm-hmm. Wisconsin idea for all those reasons.
Are there any other notable stories or memories just from this period of working in the anti-sweatshop movement?
If I weren't sitting in front of a microphone,
yeah.
I might. I have to say that one of the most moving experiences of my entire life came in 2011, watching graduate students from the UW-Madison occupy the Capitol in response to Act 10, mm-hmm. and build a community there that functioned for a couple of months, mm-hmm. with its own garbage collection system, mm-hmm. and daycare and music and little clinic for people who were sick, mm-hmm. and that community that it built that supported the much broader movement, mm-hmm. Against Act 10 was a beautiful thing for me to see, and it became the model for Occupy Wall Street, mm-hmm. The fall after, yeah. what they did in the spring. And so, that was eventually an unsuccessful struggle, but it mobilized, they were the heart of a movement that mobilized 100,000 people at a time to come out and express their feelings about what was happening. Mm-hmm. So that for me was a bittersweet, it was mm-hmm. exciting, it was sad, it was painful, it was beautiful, mm-hmm. but a really emotional moment.
Yeah. In terms of your activism and the university's support, how did you navigate that throughout your time here?
I never found it an issue, because this campus has always been, at the forefront of these kinds of mm-hmm. social change innovations. Our economics department and sociology department, were at the forefront of developing new programs like Social Security and workers' compensation and the NLRA and, you know, just a lot of different programs, both in the progressive era and the New Deal. Mm-hmm. And it was why nobody raised an eyebrow when I chose Frances Perkins as the name for the professorship that I was mm-hmm. given, because she was Roosevelt's Secretary of Labor, and she was really involved in supporting labor, and nobody questioned that. Mm-hmm. It was so tied to university yeah. traditions of support for social movements. So, I mean, there's not total agreement on campus. There's always a discussion mm-hmm. of what the right policy is or what the right path is, but I've always felt like there couldn't have been a better place to work for social justice in the context of an academic job.
Mm. That's so great. So shifting to your university service career, we just talked about this, but overall opinions of faculty governance and working at UW, if there's anything else you'd like to touch on for that.
Faculty governance is a beautiful thing, and it's so important. And I hope we never lose that tradition, because it's not just faculty governance, but, you know, academic staff and students are also involved in a lot of that work. Mm-hmm. And it is a way of, it's democracy at work, and it allows people to have a say about how things are done in their institution. Mm-hmm. It prevents alienation. It means that policies are made with more information provided by the people that mm-hmm. they directly affect. But as someone once said, democracy is an endless meeting. And so it's very, very labor intensive. Mm-hmm. And as the reporting norms and the audits and the quality control measures have become more intense in recent years, I think the service load on faculty has reached a point where it is really daunting. I mean, that's part of what happened to me in 2014. I couldn't do it for two units, because what had to be done in each unit had grown so greatly over the years. Mm-hmm. So there has to be a solution for that. And I don't really have one to offer right at this moment, but I think it's a tension that we're mm-hmm. feeling. And I really hope that it doesn't lead to lessening the degree of faculty governance.
Mm-hmm. Sorry to circle back, but I just was thinking about, because I wanted to sort of wrap up with questions about just, like, overall moments that stand out at your time at UW, but circling back to all of those victories that you mentioned before in terms of just the anti-sweatshop movement, what did those feel like, and what was, when you heard the good news, what was that environment like with your students, and if you want to talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah, it was just inspirational. It was a feeling that, okay, we know this isn't the biggest victory in the world, but this is changing real people's lives, and we did this, and it wouldn't have happened if we hadn't had this idea and stuck with it, mm-hmm. and this is an effective model, and we can do this again. It was just, it was so empowering, and it was what led so many of those students to go on and seek careers doing this in other contexts, for the AFL-CIO, for the International Union League. Some have gone on to get PhDs in economics in departments where they can, like at UMass Amherst, where they can do a more kind of social justice economics. It makes you feel like you're not just in the so-called ivory tower, but that you are doing things that matter.
Is there anything else that was a defining moment for you at UW, or that you, just looking back at your time, that you'd like to talk about? I know that's a huge question. Mm-hmm. Take your time.
It was really, really powerful for me to see the Women's Studies program become a department. Mm-hmm. I remember going to talk to the Board of Regents about the issue, testifying to a group of people who didn't necessarily believe that area studies programs and I what they thought of as identity politics programs were substantive enough to have a place in the curriculum. Being able to lay out the history of what we had done, what our graduates had gone on to do, what we taught, how many students we had taught, what a difference we had made in the lives of communities and individual people. To make that case and to have people who weren't predisposed to get it, and then to endorse that idea, that was really powerful. And it was a real, really good example of how faculty governance can work. But having said all those things, I do want to say that I'm worried now. I'm worried about the campus. And there are a couple of things that are really troubling. One is the loss of the public sector unions, the loss of representation for our staff and for our graduate students. The other is the flat budgets, which mean that people are no longer thinking about building new things. They're thinking about rearranging the deck chairs, to use that metaphor on the Titanic, to try to keep what we have going. Mm-hmm. They're thinking about making do with less. And at the same time, pressured, like many other state universities around the country, I would say the pressure is exerted by conservative lawmakers, but they're doing it in many different states throughout the country. The administration is adopting a new budget model that emphasizes costs and benefits very narrowly defined. So is a department producing more grant money and more tuition dollars than it is paying out in faculty and staff salaries? It was introduced as a tiny component of the budget model. It's now grown to 10 or 15%. Eventually it will be 50% of the budget model. And what that means is that departments that are dealing with the topics that are important but not as popular, classics for example, are not going to be able to justify their existence. And we are seeing departments close down, comp lit, folklore. We've seen the languages grouped together in one unit. So it means that kind of basic research in key areas may not get done in favor of the flavor of the moment, whatever looks like it's the best preparation for the job market at that moment, which may be true but may not be true 10 years from now. So it's a very short-term gain type model. And so I worry about those forces changing the university, eroding the infrastructure, both human and otherwise.
Mm-hmm. So what's next for you?
So I will retire officially in May. I still have some students to get through, some graduate students who are likely to take another year or so to finish. I have been doing some expert testimony for Planned Parenthood that's really rooted in my work on Milwaukee, that looks at laws that restrict access to abortion by imposing additional requirements, 2-day waiting periods or ultrasound requirements or physician-only laws, and look at the costs that those imply and what those costs mean for women living at or near the poverty line. Mm-hmm. Basically testifying that these women lose their right to an abortion because the costs are beyond what they can bear. Mm-hmm. So I've testified in 4 court cases so far, and as the different laws don't seem to be stopping, I anticipate that I'll continue to do some of that work in the future. I imagine that I will continue doing research and writing. I won't be constrained by needing to publish it necessarily in peer-reviewed journals. You know, I can write for outlets that have reached different publics. Mm-hmm. And in the immediate future, I am going to be a grandmother for the first time in the spring, so I'm looking forward to that.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Can you describe the work you did in Milwaukee?
Yes, I did a project interviewing 40 women who had transitioned off what was then called Aid to Families with Dependent Children. And I looked at their trajectories. I looked at when they were working, when they were using social services, and also at life events, such as the birth of a child or an illness. And then I mapped that against things like the economic climate, unemployment rates, policy changes in terms of eligibility for social programs. And I kind of used those timelines that I developed for each of the 40 women. We did really in-depth interviews with each of them to sort of see what led them to be able to take a job, to lose a job, to be in a situation where they had to turn to social services. And we found that health events and events concerning the health of a family member or child, the inability to get to the fact that they weren't working in jobs with sick leave and were too poor to be able to make use of the Family Medical Leave Act, that was responsible for 94% of job losses. So we really showed the interaction between what's happening in the low-wage labor market and what was happening in households, you know, and how that was influenced by the policy climate. So large-scale surveys that have been done on this issue can correlate variables, but we were doing an approach that was more like opening the hood of the car and looking to see how the engine is connected. We were looking at how events in one sphere of life reverberate into other spheres of life. And it was really, really moving research. And we told the stories of women who got trapped in situations where they were not able to, in the time frame that we could look at, get off of social services. And we looked at, although, you know, there's a time limit, they couldn't rely on them too long. And then we looked at situations where women were successful and were able to get some kind of job security.
That's so cool. So is there anything else you'd like to say?
I think I've said everything.
That's so bad. Well, then that concludes our interview. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.